Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, we get into a conversation about one of the country's biggest banks, that is Capitec. But more importantly, we're going to be talking to the author of a new book called Stalking Giants, and that is TJ Stratum. And we're going to try and understand a little bit about what he's learned around this bank. We keep hearing about the challenger banks, and I don't know, after all these years, if we can still call them a challenger bank. He'll let us know, how we define them in the market right now. That has typically been characterized by the big four banks, and then also trying to get some insight into what the history of the bank could possibly hint to us about the future of that bank. So TJ, greetings to you today, my friend.
Let me do one.
All right. So me and TJ used to work together a couple of years ago in this very same building at Arena. We were both at Sunday Times once upon a time. When I moved to Business Day, we were still sitting next to each other. So many long conversations.
And you always had a better work ethic than me. I wasn't popular on some of management, I think.
Well, given your output on the book front, I would beg to differ, because since then you've written a couple of books.
Yeah.
Cursory glance, and I say cursory glance because it's surface level, before mm-hmm. someone even goes deep. Are you intentionally trying to document Stellenbosch associated stories?
So not intentionally, but I've sort of wanted to start with the companies I find the most interesting.
Okay.
And I think Naspers is up there.
Yeah.
Mnet MultiChoice for me. That's why I wrote the book about Koos Bekker. And Capitec to me has always been quite interesting.
Mm.
Pep was started in the Northern Cape, but some would say, due to the links with Christo Wiese, that probably makes it Stellenbosch adjacent, Pepkor, Steinhoff. So it's all sort of in that universe. But I think part of it is
And that's why I said associated. I didn't want to say necessarily.
Yeah. And I also think, I think it's a cheap shot to talk about the Stellenbosch Mafia. I know there's been a book out there, and I know it's sold very well. And I know it was offered to me to write that book by my publisher before I wrote my first book.
Yeah.
And I said no, because I didn't think there's a story in that sense. But I do see the interest. I'm myself quite interested in how the network works and how people manage to build businesses from an unlikely place, because Stellenbosch is not supposed to be Silicon Valley.
Yeah,
it's fair enough. It has some of those attributes. You've got close to an airport. There's a university close by, but I don't think the leveraging of those things are the same. Because if you think of Silicon Valley, why did it start there? There was already sort of a venture capital idea going with movies. Because movies, if you make movies in California, they make movies. If you make movies, it's basically taking a big punt on an idea that you don't know whether it will work or not. Maybe I just don't know enough, but I can't really think of a Stellenbosch-based movie industry or a Boland-based movie industry that would suggest that would be the same.
Yeah.
But definitely lots of individuals who spent time together in whatever, whether it's residences or in social circles, where there was a sort of an accelerated vetting process. Mm. So you can see who's trustworthy or not. You can see who's smart and who's not.
Mm.
And I think the generation that I've mostly written about, Christo Wiese, Koos Bekker, in this instance, Michiel Leroux has quite a big role in this book. They are from that generation.
Yeah.
Studied in the late 60s, early 70s. South Africa was a very different place then. But they sort of moved into this network where a lot was possible just because because the world was changing.
Mm.
But I think they were lucky in a sense, but they were obviously pretty clever and pretty good with what they did.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to come back to this point because I think there's one or two things I'd like to touch on, especially that network that uh-huh. you're talking about in that specific generation. But before we get to that point, we as the public, I'm still working my way through the book. You know, mm-hmm. I'll admit that I haven't finished the book.
You haven't had a flight. I mean, I wrote it so you can read it on a return flight from Joburg to Cape Town. So
But from what I've read so far, I like the language used. You know, you write quite, you know, in an accessible way. But what I was going to say is, from the outside, right? We think of Capitec as a bank. You think in your head the white, red, and blue logo,
mm-hmm.
and you've also got the typeface, you know, mm-hmm. On the front of the book that they particularly use, and
very close to the typeface. I don't think we could actually use the real one. We got very as close as
well.
You can.
Well, it passes. Yes. It passes. So, my view? I'm trying to represent like the ordinary person on the street mm. now. When you think of Capitec and you're like retail bank, you know, cheaper fees in the market, very big, retail customer base in the country. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff, you know, it's almost well known, well documented. But your definition of or how you think of Capitec, has that changed in any way, or did your research in writing the book almost cement whatever preconceived notions or ideas you had of what Capitec is?
So obviously, when you do research for a book, you try to challenge your own assumptions about whether it's a brand or a company or a topic. So I obviously challenged my assumptions, but I think Capitec's way of presenting themselves is probably quite transparent.
Mm.
And so it was closer to what I would have thought it would be. I obviously got a lot more detail about certain ways that they approach things, ways that they built their brand. And there's a chapter about the genius thing that they did where they actually wanted to go very mainstream, very big. And, you know, the idea of, or let's say the perception that people have of Capitec, I think is pretty close to what it really is.
Mm.
But as a consumer, you obviously think differently about a business than if you were an investor. If you're an investor, you think, you know, these guys, they need to execute their plan. They need to do this, and they've mostly surprised investors on the upside. So mostly investors were surprised to see that, you know, Capitec went from 1 million to 2 million clients, then to 5, then to 10, and now it's on 23 million. Again, it's South Africa, so there's always a bit of double counting when it comes to banking. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if someone's wallet falls out and the cards scatter, there are several banking cards. Yeah. There are. But, it's an interesting question that you ask, because I tried to challenge my own assumptions about Capitec, and I think some of them were confirmed, and some others I was surprised to see that they were either a bit more nimble than I thought they were.
Mm.
They were a bit more conservative in certain instances than I thought they were. Mm. But on things like capital allocation and stuff like that, incredibly conservative business. Mm. I didn't even mention this in a book, but they when they redesigned their branches, and this was around 2009, maybe 2010. So it's a proper 15 years ago. But the way the branches look now, it was basically, you know, converting them to the current look, even though they have done some upgrades since. But before that, you know, it looked like doctor's waiting rooms, basically. It's a row of chairs and some desks and a consultant.
Yeah.
But when they did that, they got an international consultancy who designed branches for, you know, for other financial institutions and retail, you know, client-facing businesses. And these guys came up with an idea, with this look, and Capitec said, great. And when it came to the final implementation, the cost for them was just too high. They just said, why do we need to import this type of perspex, and why do we need this and that? So they obviously, through the right channels, said, okay, thanks for that. Mm. We'll sort it out here. And they sourced everything that they could locally, and they went on an aggressive cost-cutting dive. But to roll out the same thing that was designed by this UK consultancy, and that thing just told me, that approach of theirs just told me that these guys will turn every rand over to see if they can't make it work. Because there was no, I mean, by then they were big and they were clearly a success. But I think that mindset of making every rand and every cent work for you, I think that's an interesting, especially I think in the banking sector, is a quite a unique thing.
So they're so efficient capital allocators.
Very efficient. And I think also the thing that they also do well is that their working capital cycle is actually quite short. Mm. So they move things through very quickly. And, you know, their example is Gerry Fourie, who's the CEO now. But he's been there from about the start. He said, if someone else grants you a loan in a day, they would aim to do it in half an hour.
Nice.
So, you know, that kind of difference, it just tells you that they want to turn it over much, much quicker. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, we talk about retail banking, but this is really a retail approach to banking. Mm. It's they don't want things to sit idly. They measure how long people take on phone calls. Mm. They measure how long someone sits in the chair in front of a consultant. They had I didn't write that in the book. And I mean, maybe it's very anecdotal and maybe it's not even true, but I heard that when a consultant sits in a branch and it is not busy with a client in front of him or her, they start forming part of the call center. So calls are patched through to them and they run that. So I couldn't confirm that officially, but I mean, even if it's just a rumor, the fact that a rumor like that is out there tells you a little something about the way Capitec is seen and the way it probably approaches business. But there's this incredible drive for efficiency.
I can believe what you're saying, because about a month and a half ago, I interacted with the technology team at Capitec, and the question I was asking them is around the use of AI, because everyone and their cat is talking about AI right
Absolutely.
Now, right? And it was, you know, how are they using it, you know, for customer service, call centers, that type of thing. And basically they said, because they were together with their partners from Amazon Web Services, and they said that they are working on a system where, you know, using AI to your earlier point, how do we shorten that interaction, or how do we make that interaction as efficient as possible? Because that one of the things that sucks the most about calling any call center, right, whether it's your entertainment provider or your bank, is that you tend to be bounced around different people, and you tend to have to tell each one of these people your life story. Absolutely. Oh, I'm having this problem, right?
Yeah, but for and then please hold.
Exactly,
I'll find out.
But now it's okay. Music. Let's use AI to at least know who TJ is.
Yeah,
right. When TJ calls, the AI already. Maybe it's the idle teller or someone who's in the call center, or that person. The moment that TJ gets patched through, they get a proper synopsis. Mm-hmm. This is the third time that TJ has called us in the last 6 days. He called about this, this, and this. This is how much progress has been made. Before he starts telling you his life story, here's his life story. Yeah. Right?
You can see it on the screen and you can just run with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what is the sense that you get, Mudi? Are the other banks Are they, to the same extent, interested in that kind of thing? Because, I mean, as you say, everyone talks about AI now, but do you think they are as aggressive and with such a clear view of what they want to do with it?
Do you see use of AI in, I'm going to call it, three distinct uses that companies are making use of it. You either take a NASPA/process approach where you create a platform, but your platform becomes an internal tool.
Okay.
Right.
Yes.
They had a, I'm just forgetting what the name of the tool is now, but it started its life as a platform called Plus One.
Yes, I remember Plus One. And I think we were on a tip together with NASPA, and I suggested they should call it Quiz One or something like that, or Ask Quiz.
Yes. So that platform is an internal tool. It's not a customer-facing tool, right? It's meant to make them and their portfolio companies more efficient, right? Mm. How do you get the most out of a developer? How do you get the most out of someone who's trying to come up with a marketing plan for iFood, for eMag or whatever it is, right? So internal tool. Then you've got the ones that are trying to create platforms that they can sell, you know, into the public. Think Microsoft Copilot, Google Gemini, and the most famous being ChatGPT, of course, right? And then you've got this other piece, which the banks seem to be quite obsessed, with and about, because I've spoken to a number of banks. I think most recently on the same platform, we were talking to the chief information officer at Absa's retail bank.
Okay.
Everyone is, the obsession with, especially the retail operations in the banks, is how do you improve the customer experience using this AI thing? Because if we are trying to shift all these people onto digital channels, then the impression they're going to have of their interaction with us is going to come down to that, how good of a digital experience that they have, how useful, it is. Because the use of AI is only as good as what the platform is, right? If I can get more done by calling a human being. Because remember, that's one of the things that a lot of people try to put the technology intervention, but the technology interventions fall short.
It wasn't ready yet. And also, they didn't think about it, in a holistic way. They thought the tech will solve it for us.
Exactly.
But that was the thing. Capitec, when they started, they used available technology, but it was far advanced to what the other banks could actually roll out at the time, because the other banks had legacy systems, so they could plug in the newest, most expensive stuff either on the front end or somewhere in the back end, but they couldn't make the whole thing new, whereas Capitec could use available technology for that. And I think maybe AI now gives you the opportunity to, it's advanced enough so you can plug it in somewhere and get an efficiency there, whereas it all doesn't need to work together. Necessarily.
No, it is an interesting, it is an interesting place. And that psychology around Capitec is something that I'm very interested in. And there was a passage that I found at the beginning of your chapter 8 that I, wanted to ask you about. And I think you've already been hinting at it a little bit. It's just a quick paragraph.
Is that the focus chapter? Which
yes.
one? Is it?
Oh, yeah,
yes.
That's the one. To quote TJ, he says, Capitec wanted to be a bank, nothing else, and initially nowhere else other than in South Africa. And it wanted to grant loans and open savings account. That was all. But with growing client numbers, an extensive branch network, and an ever stronger brand, there was, of course, always the alluring possibility of fat profits through the sale of other products.
Mm-hmm.
So, evolution of Capitec. We've seen them going down some very interesting paths. I know personally a number of people that have been poached from some of the banks to, build up their business banking outfit, for example. They bought, I think, Mercantile Bank a couple of years ago, and they're now, building that up. Lots of innovation on the retail side. Could we, I'm just throwing it out there, because for a number of the banks, Could we one day realistically see a, I know it's a different type of bank, but could we see one day a Capitec corporate and investment bank? Is that a...
Yeah, so let me just quickly throw a disclaimer out there. Cool, yeah. Whatever people are listening now, remember what I do now is I'm not giving any investment advice or whatever. So let me just – but I think Capitec has the stated intention to make their business bank at least as big as each of the other four's business banking division.
Yeah.
Which for them would mean 10 times or 20 times bigger than it is now.
Yeah. So lots of growth.
There's lots of headroom, and let's be bullish and say it's a growing economy, and you know, South Africa is on the up and up again. So then it's growth in a growing environment. So it could be a lucrative business if they are as aggressive, which they have shown. I mean, they on price, they're very aggressive. But I think with business banking, often the difference, your clients don't respond to price as much as they do to efficiency or the things that you offer them.
Yeah, the service.
Yeah, whereas in retail banking, you know, a large part of South Africa in the early 2000s thought they were, either they found banks intimidating or they thought they were being ripped off in terms of costs. So there was a challenger brand narrative that Capitec could position there and sort of riff off for a decade and a half. Is business banking a bit different? But I would be surprised if they don't do that. But I don't see them acquiring corporate finance, you know, house somewhere else or acquiring anything more. I think the business bank experience, this is my view based on interviews, not their what they say, but I think it was more difficult to digest than I thought it would be. And I think it's probably tainted their idea of whether they would acquire something again, or I mean, I think a small bolt-on acquisition here and there, maybe.
Yeah.
But anything substantial or anything where there's an existing system that they then have to transform, I don't see them doing that. So they would probably build in-house capability slowly as a, you know, corporate and investment bank. But they are in a great spot for that because, you know, if you want to service a very, I mean, there's a lot of churn in that Stellenbosch area, and there's a lot happening. And I think many of the corporate finance players up here in Joburg don't know how to service that specifically.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
So it would give them a slight competitive, well, maybe a huge competitive advantage if they were able to service that, but you know, grow slowly and organically with that. But yeah, I mean, the sort of animal that Absa Capital is now, or Barclays Capital was, I don't see them buying something like that. They would probably grow it.
And I like the fact that you're bringing up the Absa Barclays thing, because that's actually the reason I asked about them possibly getting into the CIB market is because one of the biggest narratives around Capitec is that they have largely taken up market share from an Absa,
yes,
right? But currently what, you know, some argue keeps the lights on at Absa is this corporate investment banking, you know, unit that they've been able to develop. It seems to have, at least for now, it's keeping, you know, everything else. It's keeping everything else alive. Whereas back in the day, it was a very retail heavy focused, you know, type of operation. So
that's what Absa got from Barclays, is that capability. And it's strange because it, you know, you'd think they were well poised to do that long before Barclays took them over, but I think they were just a very good retail operation, and they sort of leached into everything. And you know, back then, home loans was a big deal. They were, I think they were number one in home loans by far. But in that early 2000s, you know, the property market shooting through the roof. If you're milking it there, you don't really look for other places to start something from scratch. And maybe Barclays did them a bit of a favor there, apart from the opposite of a favor, a disfavor they did them by acquiring them and letting them go again.
Mm. What makes in your view? It's two questions in one, but these to come off the passage, you know, that I just read, where all you're trying to do is take deposits and give loans, but you now start venturing down all of these other parts because you've got scale that allows you to make even obscure types of products profitable, as long as, you know, you can get a decent enough portion of your 23 million plus
to buy a lotto ticket.
Buy a lotto ticket, electricity, you know, Showmax, whatever it is, right?
Well, all the thing is, you're actually getting them to just buy it from you. Yes. They're already buying it. You can see in their accounts they are going to a retailer and buying a lotto ticket or paying for the electricity or buying data.
Yeah.
But now you're just bringing it in-house, which means you can take a little cut there.
Yeah.
And it also means you've got a lot more data points running through your system that you can use for your analysis. Yeah. Mm.
So it was simply to say, of all these things that they've gone down, these new products that they've gone down into, what has surprised you the most? Because at the beginning of the conversation, you did say that, you know, in your research, there were a couple of things that did surprise you. Were there parts that they've gone down that, you know, were like, wow, I didn't expect that they were going to, you know, do that? Because there's a mimicking of the industry. Okay, we've reached a certain point. Let's just get into what everyone else is getting into on this front. And then there are just certain things where you're like, okay, fine. You know, you just thumbsuck and then it becomes like, I think people call them the blue oceans. Let's just go find something that's, you know, odd out there.
Yeah. Throw money at it and see if it sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it took them very long before they expanded into something else. And I've said this often, but Gary Fouriez told me they want 30% market share before they move on to something new. And with savings accounts, it took them more than a decade to get there, a decade and a half about. And that's when they started a credit card. And that's when they started doing funeral policies. But there was pressure from the shareholders to do that, you know, much earlier, to do that in the early 2000s already. And Rian Stassen, the CEO at the time, he resisted that pressure. And he said, we are going to build this thing to a certain scale. We want it to run at volume and with certain efficiencies, and only when it became that big, and only when Gary Fouriez took over as CEO in, what was that, 2014, did they slowly start positioning themselves to sell stuff. Now, I was quite surprised when they started this virtual network.
Yeah. Capitec Connect.
Yes, but apparently they were thinking of starting it even earlier. Mm. Well, that at least is the rumor out there. That's why I never write the rumor. I remember the rumor because I can use it in an interview. But they could have done that earlier. And the interesting thing about this is now when they sell things, and you're asking me what surprises me. In retrospect, it doesn't surprise me, but I thought it was strange that they would start selling entertainment packages. Mm. Why would you sell a Showmax or a DSTV? Why would you go in there? But it makes sense because it is that world in which the mobile operators wanted to operate in.
Mm.
They wanted to not be a dump pipe for data just pumps you. You know, they were worried they're going to turn into utilities.
Mm.
So they started exploring, you know, selling value-added entertainment services.
Mm.
But it never really gained the kind of traction that they wanted. It's just other platforms were better at it. I mean, Apple is just better at getting people to subscribe to their music than I would think MTN is. I don't know the numbers, but anecdotally,
you're probably right. Yeah,
I can't imagine that. Yeah, and I mean the same. They'd rather be. It's more likely to be a completely new player coming in and disrupting that market, a Spotify, for example, than a mobile operator latching onto it. Because, I mean, they're infrastructure companies. They like selling minutes and SMSs. That's their business. Mm. But for me, it's interesting that Capitec is going into that business. But it makes sense because they have a very clear distribution platform. So they can show these 23 million people, lots of them are buying airtime already. Lots of them are buying electricity through us already. So it's a proven sales platform. Mm. And I think that's the thing where they'll probably have the vendors will be more interested in working with Capitec than maybe it would be clear that the consumers want it necessarily to buy Showmax vouchers from them. Mm. And I find that interesting. I wish I could flog my own book through the through their app, but apparently, I mean, this is an unauthorized project, so I can't expect them to give me 23 million clients just like that.
I'm sure that even if you were just to get 5% of that, it would be incredible for them.
Yeah, then I can finally stop writing, and I can live the dream.
Those types of products have been quite fascinating because even when they started selling the Showmax vouchers, I once again interacting with the Capitec team at the time, and you almost get a sense of two things happening there. You almost get a sense of we are doing everything in our power to keep the Capitec customer inside our garden. They must stay in our walls. And to your earlier point about the fact that you are already spending money on A, B, C, and D, right? So instead of you doing those transactions outside, keep doing those same transactions, but do it inside. And if you're inside our garden, you're doing the same transactions, but we can let you do the same transactions at a cheaper rate. Yeah. You're already paying for Showmax, but, you know, come to us and you can get it, you know, 50%. Yeah. 50% cheaper. You're already buying data, electricity, all of this stuff. There's a deal.
But distribution is expensive. If you see a little Showmax card or a Spotify card hanging in the shop, it costs someone money to get it there.
Yes.
But if it's on your app, you know, it's easy.
Yeah.
And it's digital and there's no limit to how big it can get. So it makes sense to me that the Showmaxes of the world would want to use that platform. Mm. But then the Capitec mindset is also they're not trying to make a lot of money or a decent margin off anything. They're happy with tiny little bites here and there, but at volume. So the more, as you say, the more the children play in their garden, the longer they play there, I'm struggling to continue with this metaphor, but you know the idea is let them rather make small bits from them while they're still in there.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to say as the second point, that you get that sense that for them they're not trying to make like super profits off of types of
partnerships. So we are on the same level, we're actually on the very same level.
They aren't trying to make super profits. Let's keep people in. Yeah. Let's increase our perception of value in the customer's in the customer's eye. Let's increase the number of things that this person can do within our garden. And then, you know, who knows what else. And it's also an interesting proof point for me because when Capitec got onto Cell C's network as an MVNO, there was a lot of excitement around that. A lot of people have or had written off Cell C quite a lot up until their recapitalization in 2022. But soon after that recapitalization, one of the first big deals that they made, that Cell C made, was signing Capitec as an MVNO operator. And there was a lot of excitement about that. And I remember analysts at the time, you know, made a lot of comments about the fact that Capitec is going to change the game for Cell C. Now, fast forward to 2024, 1.2 million customers on the on that mobile network, and it's possibly going to grow even more. And it's already, I guess, paying dividend. I also saw the.
It's already profitable. They said it's split down. It's not, you know, it doesn't shoot the lights out.
It doesn't shoot the lights out. I think they said 36 odd million that it's contributing to earnings, you know, from the last. I stand to be corrected on that number.
Yeah, no, I think that was the number I had in my head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also interesting to see from the last results as well that on the Showmax, 56,000 vouchers already, you know, into the market that they've been able to. And I guess over time, they're steadily going to be growing, you know, all of these things. So, yeah, no, it's a very fascinating thing.
What do you think of a counter, let's say, a counter-historical, and Capitec doesn't buy a business bank, but they buy Cell C in 2019? Ooh. What do you think would have happened?
Wow.
Or do you think Capitec is better suited at having the MVNO and not having to worry about all of the other regulatory issues that a big telecom has to worry about?
Sure.
Because the compliance and those kind of things. Imagine Capitec's management now have to deal with ICASA too, and with.
I was gonna say the headaches would be too much for them. Interestingly, at some point, two of Cell C's big, I'm going to call them stakeholders, because it starts off with the debt relationship, but because of the recapitalization, some of that then get converted to equity, etc. Yeah. It was Nedbank and Absa.
Yes.
That were inside, what you call this, Cell C. And it clearly caused them, you know, headaches,
a lot of pain.
Yeah, quite a bit of pain. But when you then contrast that to FNB and how much success they, you know, they have, they've had with their MVNO, I think Capitec just took the less risky route. I think by buying a mobile operator as a bank. Because you're already in a heavily regulated space. Now you're just adding even more, right? Mm-hmm. And especially a sector that has a lot of political connotations around it as well, you know, that are tied into that regulation that we're talking about. I think it would just be too much.
It would probably never have happened. But it's interesting because, you know, at the time, Cell C was, I think, in enough trouble to be a, you know, you'd probably walk in and say what your price would be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also, yeah.
But I don't think we should close the door to that, though.
Who knows?
Who knows?
But it looks like a comfortable deal that they have now.
Right now, I think it's a nice, cushy partnership that they are.
Yeah. And maybe, what is Cell C? Are they running the other retailers' MVNOs too?
So right now, South Africa has roughly 18 MVNOs. The thing that's driving MVNO activity, part of it on the mobile operator side, is regulation.
Yeah. Right?
This regulatory piece that we're talking about. Last spectrum auction, March 2022, one of the stipulations that's tied to these spectrum licenses is you need to have MVNOs operating on at least one MVNO operating on your
to make it a fairer playing field.
All of the
narrative. Yes. Yeah.
So remember, Cell C, this has always been Cell C's game. Virgin Mobile, Mr. Price, FNB, Standard Bank, all of these, you know, operators. And then you quickly, after that auction, you start seeing some aggression coming from MTN.
Yeah.
They sign on Pick and Pay, and they've recently.
Where's ShopRite? Aren't they on there too?
I'm actually not sure, you know, with that one.
Yeah.
So they start, they do Pick and Pay, then they poach Standard Bank from Cell C.
Okay.
Right. And now Vodacom looks like I don't want to say that's what they're doing, but they've also signed Mr. Price, which has traditionally been on Cell C.
Okay.
And you're trying to see, are they going to do a power sharing? Yes. Because FNB is currently doing a power sharing between Cell C and MTN. Or does Vodacom do what, or does Vodacom just take Mr. Price away? So it's a very interesting, space. But at least for now, it looks like Capitec is like Cell C is our guys.
Yeah.
And we're going to stick by them. And they're adding. Because remember, from an MVNO point of view, Cell C is chasing 10 million customers.
Yeah.
And if Capitec is just in a short burst of time,
got zero to 1.2 in 18 months. So.
That's it's crazy.
Yeah, and that thing it's the kind of thing that can go exponentially.
Mm.
But that's part of this interesting world where the barriers between telecommunications and financial services and certain forms of retail, it's just totally disappearing, yes. Isn't it?
Yeah.
It looks like that's where Capitec is positioning themselves to be one of these strange hybrids that also have a banking license.
Yeah.
They have the banking license, but they've got an insurance license. Mm. So they sell insurance like there's no tomorrow. And if I was an established South African insurer, Sanlam or Old Mutual, I definitely wouldn't then write them off because the big banks did that back in the day.
And look where they are now.
Look where they are now. They did that with a competitor that didn't have the distribution platform that it has now.
Mm.
So Capitec could potentially it might take some time, but they could potentially be the biggest life insurer in the country. It would take time.
Mm.
But now you ask me, will they then, does a corporate investment bank fit with a Capitec? If you have a large life insurance business, then obviously asset management starts to fit in with that.
Yeah.
If you have asset management.
Warren Buffett model. Yeah.
Exactly. So all of it all starts moving closer to each other. If you do a lot of massive deals in-house, maybe you need your own brokerage. Maybe you need. So you start becoming this broader financial services player. And some of the bizarrest things could happen. You could now, maybe years later, have Capitec taking over PSG.
Wow.
Why not?
Why not?
If it fits in with their... So again, I don't think they'll do a big acquisition.
No.
But I mean, that fits in more with them going into that
type of world.
Space, yeah.
You know what you're saying? One of the things I was going to ask, and I think what you're talking about now is leading us down that path a little bit. I made a statement earlier on, about we've always thought about the big four banks.
Yeah.
Right.
Capitec calls them the traditional four because they say they're already the traditional big. Four. They're the big themselves.
Some people, now consider it to be the big five.
Yes.
Right.
Which has a ring to it, doesn't it?
It does. But my question is just more around, what do you see as, because we find ourselves in a very interesting place. I find TymeBank to be very interesting, and especially their growth trajectory, their ability to reach the 10 million customer mark as quickly as
they have.
It's been very quick. But I'm just wondering, banking landscape, let's say 20 years ago, right? The thing that has made Capitec become now what we now consider big five versus a lot of the smaller banks that have existed in the market, Grindrod, Sasfin, African Bank, all of these players. And at some point, you could have counted Capitec amongst them, but Capitec escapes, that league. They sort of operate in this in between, and they're in the big leagues, right? But now, the same nimbleness that they have displayed in the market is what has made TymeBank, Discovery Bank, and all of these other guys, grow as much as that they have.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess I just wonder whether how they are compared to fintechs. We often ask the traditional banks, do you see fintechs as enemies or foes?
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to Capitec, I struggle to think to myself, is Capitec essentially, I guess, a giant fintech company?
If you talk to the right analyst, they'll say, oh, this thing is a fintech.
Yeah.
You know, it's happy with, what's the number, 8.5% bad debt ratio. I think that was the number. Mm. They're happy with certain things that make them look like a fintech.
Mm.
But what they, and they carry a lot of capital compared to other banks. That's the other thing. Their capital adequacy is massive.
Mm.
But they're just probably more of a massive old school micro lender kind of thing.
Mm.
And it sounds a fintech. Yes, maybe a fintech is a micro lender. And yes, maybe you can't call Capitec a micro lender because you can get a home loan there now. And mm. For years, they've granted people hundreds of thousands of rands in loans, as individuals. But I think it's more something like that than it is. I mean, we've both spent some time with the Naspers fintechs in India.
Mm.
Capitec doesn't look like that. Mm. It's just not that no. kind of thing. And I think the bricks and mortar presence of Capitec also makes it look less like a fintech and more like one of those, a very advanced now and a very institutionalized 1990s credit organization in South Africa.
Yeah.
And, the argument from Capitec's side is always that that people, there's a certain part of the population that still needs face-to-face contact.
Mm.
So they need that option. They need to be able to walk into a branch. But if you go and look at their branches now, they've also made it possible for someone, if you walk into a branch that you don't have to talk to someone, there's a machine there where you print out a proof of address or a statement and you just leave. You never talk to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that very interesting. So they've got a bricks and mortar presence that just, part of it is face-to-face, but part of it is just machines.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know if that's a response to the Time Bank, their distribution platform,
yeah,
which are machines in retailers, but maybe it is.
Or maybe it's just the efficiency that we're talking about earlier on.
Yeah.
Like, what's the most efficient way of running a branch, right? Do I really need? I mean, if you're going to repurpose someone during their idle time to become part of the call center, right, then you're also looking at how do I also, other parts of this flow inside the bank.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
And I think that's what they have that. They've got the executives still go to branches. They still go and have a look at what people do there. And, I'm sure at the traditional four banks, they obviously also visit branches sometimes, but I don't think it's that same frequency and that with the same vigor that you probably see a Harry Fourie trying to check out what a branch does, which is maybe we'll still touch on that. But I think one of the more interesting things at Capitec will be succession and what happens after, because everyone who's been in top management or who's run the company in the last 20 years, they were basically part of the founders. Mm. They were part of that first group who came in.
Mm.
And it is very very, very different, not difficult necessarily, but different when you are a career manager as opposed to an entrepreneurial manager.
It's very interesting that you're bringing that up. I feel like, I think TJ has a look inside my mental notes right now, because I was going to come back to, I wanted us to circle back to one of the things that we began talking about,
mm-hmm,
was this generation of entrepreneurs,
oh, yes,
right, that have, succeeded. And it strikes me, and this is not, we've left the Stellenbosch paradigm, but we're just looking at it nationally. Mm-hmm. Because in that generation, there are a lot of long established businesses that are still, you know, with us today. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I was going to check with you, as someone who has studied people that grew up during that time, etc., is Malcolm Gladwell has this idea around outliers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things in his book Outliers he talks about is the Silicon Valley founders, you know, to say, if you're Steve Jobs, Michael Dell, Bill Gates, all of these guys, Bill Joy, and all of those guys, a lot of these guys are literally born within a certain time period.
Mm.
If you are, you know, too far, you know, a little bit, you know, to the left of that continuum, right, you miss the entire Silicon Valley tech craze, right? If you are born just outside on the other side of that, then you no longer have that big of an opportunity to really found these companies. You're more going to be working.
You're
going
to work there.
Yeah.
You're going to do an executive MBA somewhere and then slot in at the top, and you have to steer this big ship with all its capital, and, you know. Yeah. And you get grilled when you misallocate capital.
Exactly.
Where a founder, it's not the same. The founder, because he's got a stake, a serious stake in there, because people have backed him or her before, I think the scrutiny is less.
Yeah. So that's the thing I'm keen to understand from your point of view. What helped, you know, these guys, you know, from that generation? What are the influences? Is it resilience? Like, what is it? You have these CEOs that are sitting and literally keeping shareholder pressure at bay. Guys, open up these new product lines. No, we only when we get to a certain point, that strength, that muscle. And I guess, you know, as you're answering that, maybe also how does that feed into that succession that succession discussion?
So the most of the guys we talk about, let's say they're baby boomers now, but most of them grew up in the 60s, where the 60s South Africa, well, let's say they came of age in the 60s. It was a time of high economic growth, so it was boom times. But then the 70s, you have the oil crises.
Very lean times.
You've got the Soweto uprisings. You've got a time of turbulence. This is the time where they are working for someone else. That, and up until, let's say, the late 80s.
Yeah.
I'm using Michiel Leroux now as an example. He was the MD of Distillers Corporation for 14 years. By 1994, he was a highly experienced executive, but he'd worked through these turbulent times. A guy like Rian Stassen had worked with him there at Distillers. But in the turbulent times, I think you needed to find out if you're in any sort of a retail business and you want to still make money, you needed to find out how to deliver products to difficult places. You needed to understand how townships work. You couldn't, like the generation before you, say, no, but South Africa is going to develop in this way, and, you know, we focus on the cities, and that doesn't. They couldn't. They had to understand how that worked. And they could actually see it develop in front of their eyes. Because, you know, before the 80s, the size of South Africa's cities just wasn't that big. By the mid 80s, you had lots of urbanization happening, and it's because of, you know, plenty of restrictive measures that came down. But you suddenly had an influx of millions of consumers to the large cities, and again they sort of saw that happening. And by the time you have South Africa's economy again opening up to the rest of the world, they are in their mid 40s. Early 40s to mid 40s, which is, as a man of 44, I can tell you, that is when you start getting itchy and you think, I've got to make a plan now. Otherwise, I'm going to be stuck in this life that I have now. So if you're happy to, you know, to play it out and take the easy route, then you'll retire maybe comfortably or maybe uncomfortably.
Yeah.
But by your mid-40s, that's the time when people start taking risks. Mm. And they were lucky that, again, when they knew, you know, times of prosperity, they knew times of turbulence, they understood consumers, and by the mid-90s, they were ready to do their own thing. And for good ideas back then, you could raise the capital. Mm. You could get it going because, you know, suddenly the international markets were happy to invest. Suddenly there was, you know, lots of churn from these old conglomerates that were either dismantling or unbundling, you know, and the concentration in the economy is always a theme that people talk about. But the churn in the early 90s and early 2000s, mid 90s, early 2000s, it was fascinating.
Yeah.
So if you're poised, if you walk into that situation and you are a chartered accountant or a lawyer, mm-hmm. someone professional who has some real business experience, this is a golden time for you.
Yeah.
So, yes, and again, someone had to do those deals and someone had to build companies then. Even though they were white, there was no way to get around it. It was the situation where it was going to happen. Mm. And I think the ones that were clever, they partnered with the right empowerment shareholders at the time. But I'm surprised that the partnering wasn't better done. It was like I'm quite surprised that there wasn't this massive, you know, let's work together and build something incredible. Mm. But I think it goes back to that network effect. You work with the people that you know and trust. Yeah. And that, you know, by the time they were in their 50s, their ideas had either worked or failed. Mm. By the time they were in the 60s, they were either billionaires or not. Mm. And I think that stuff is interesting. Gilles Roux has this quote, I quote him somewhere in the book, where he says, Capitec will either be a big success or a small failure.
I like that very much.
Yeah.
I like that. And what type of mindset, you know, based on everything that you've just said now, what's the mindset that is able to take Capitec forward, do you think, especially as we inevitably have to see a change of what you call this, a change mm-hmm. of the guard, and a lot of corporates are, you know, grappling, you know, with this.
Banks specifically. Right, banks, you know, there's quite a good case study in South Africa of a bank that hasn't been able to do their succession well.
Yeah.
So I think with Capitec, the interesting thing is to me, it seems like management is still very curious about what they can do in South Africa and how their consumers think and how their consumers develop and change. And I think as long as Capitec has that, and this is on many levels, you know, where I've interacted with people there, they want to solve a puzzle. Mm. It's like this puzzle, and I think it goes all the way back to what those guys wanted to do in the mid-90s to, 2001, which was the founding of Capitec. They wanted to solve this puzzle of how do you create something that can provide financial services to everyone in the country, mm. or 95% of the country, whereas the other banks are looking at, we want 20%. We want the most lucrative part of the most lucrative part. That's all they wanted. Mm. But I think that curiosity about the client and the customer, as long as that stays there, which to me it looks like it will. And it also looks like as if Capitec definitely they try a cultural fit more than anything else when they employ someone. I think if they can keep their culture the way it is now, they'll probably do well. Mm. But there's a lot of change there. There's a lot of, you know, there are thousands of new employees that have come in the last few years. At head office and, you know, up here in the old mercantile offices that work in data and, you know, IT and, you know, very advanced tech kind of things, or very specialized, you know, credit analysis, data analysis things. And it's interesting because, you know, that means there's a lot of new blood coming in, and it means that the culture itself, just because of, you know, hundreds of new people coming in, could obviously change. So obviously you don't know what a company is like in terms of onboarding and those things if you haven't worked there. I mean, I can tell you what onboarding was like in the media, but I assume it's very different at a world-beating financial services company. But yeah, so I'm not sure I answer your question, but I think there's an opportunity for Capitec to become really big if they can manage to keep doing, not necessarily doing the actual things they're doing, but, you know, having that their way of thinking and translating that to whatever their new challenges are.
Yeah,
Harry Fury is, I mean, widely quoted as saying he's more worried about Apple Pay and a sort of weaponized WhatsApp weaponized is my word, not his. Than the big banks.
Oh wow!
He thinks if someone can put a payment platform on something that we use to send each other videos of, you know, of our grandchildren on, then you've got trouble. And that's that super app kind of thing that you have, the 10-cent method. So if someone gets that right, then it'll be interesting. But the fact that they're thinking about that, to me, is a good indication of
keeping your ears to the ground.
Yes, exactly.
So on that point, we come to the end of today's conversation. It has been really great just chatting with TJ, you know, around Capitec, around, you know, Stalking Giants, you know, his new book, and just getting a sense, you know, from someone who has had to sit down and, you know, really understand, you know, how that bank, you know, operates. Yeah.
Yeah. And I haven't given the book away. There were no spoilers, spoiler alerts. I mean, I think of everything I said, hardly anything is in the book.
No, I'm glad, because it allows a person to, what you call this, actually go and, you know, read it for themselves and discover other things. But I think my biggest takeaway from this conversation, and I guess Capitec conversation as a whole, is how in the bigger picture we view maturity, you know, of a business. There's often, you know, a lot to be said about businesses or industries that have reached a certain maturity point and what we expect to see from them, and the fact that a lot of them tend to get into a more maintenance type of mindset. But for some reason, when it comes to Capitec, even though you're sitting with 23 million customers, there's just this view that there's so much more that they can do, right? So I think if I'm going to give anything to Capitec, it's that ability to be seen, to continue to be seen as a growth company, where by many measures they would be seen as a company that has either peaked or is close to their peak. But the market really does seem to think that they can do so much more and in so many different areas. So from a maturity and business point of view, I do find Capitec to be very interesting. Very interesting. Also, their use of technology, because I'm very biased from this point of view as a geek, you know, observing them as a technology player and how they've used it. But you almost get the sense, and this is something that TJ was saying earlier on, that there's this obsession around efficiency. And I honestly would not even think that they've set out to be a technology leader. I think they've set out to be efficient, and technology has just proven to be the way that they get there, and the way that they attack new markets, the way that, you know, to your point just now about them hiring so many people that are just looking at data and analytics and now AI, all of this stuff. I don't think they want to be a tech company, but how do we, you know, be ruthlessly efficient? whilst at the same time being able to, you know, enter the new markets using this disciplined approach. So it has been a really great discussion, you know, just hearing about what's going on there, and also just a little bit about the type of team that came together to actually form this entity, the type of mindset that will be able to take the bank forward, and you know, some of the questions and how we're going to be waiting to see how they answer those questions when it comes to succession. TJ, anything else you know, to add as a last point before we let you go?
No, well, I just love it if every Capitec client buys my book, then then I think I'll be sorted.
No, I
think there's like lots of South African success stories, and you know, my elevator pitch is always I try to tell them in a way that's accessible to most of South Africa. So, you know, hopefully there's more to come. I have a new project I'm working on, but I think the Capitec story, it's just too good not to write up. And it lends itself maybe to a sequel one of these days, depending on whether they do international expansion well, or depending on whether they build that that insurance giant that we are sort of talking about, whether they have a corporate investment bank one of these days, that business bank becomes big, whether they're just an everything shop.
Right. So that's been it. We're in conversation with TJ Stredham. Thank you so much, TJ.
Oh, lovely. Thanks.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So from myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.